from deep inside your radio.
Yes, as I just said to Jenny here, why don't I do some radio, speaking of radio? So here I am doing it. This is radio, ladies and gentlemen. That's why you can't see me. The new F-bomb, first up. And this is another twist in the new F-bomb foreclosure, which I haven't heard much talk about, strangely enough, in the presidential campaign, even though it seems to be an issue for people. You know, people. Remember people? More and more foreclosures. What we seem to be seeing, according to what I'm reading, or what we seem to be reading according to what I'm seeing, however you phrase it, it's your show. Go. Is that the pace of foreclosures may have slowed down because banks are holding on to houses. I think we discussed this on this program, a couple weeks ago. The banks are holding on to houses, refusing to finish the foreclosure process because then they would have to, like, do the maintenance. Anyway, here we go. California neighborhoods experiencing record foreclosures also experienced lower levels of voter turnout in the 2008 presidential election. This is according to researchers at the University of California, Riverside. Riverside? They got a university. Oh, sorry. Voters who lost their homes were not the only ones who appear to have been affected, according to sociologist Vanessa Estrada Correa and political scientist Martin Johnson. They determined in a study believed to be the first to assess the effect of foreclosure on political participation that voters who remained in neighborhoods impacted by foreclosures, that is to say, where foreclosures had an impact, were less likely to vote than individuals in more stable communities. That's not communities with more stables. Don't go there. The findings appear in Foreclosure Depresses Voter Turnout, published in the peer-reviewed journal Social Science Quarterly, available online, published by the Southwestern Social Science Association. My copy, the boy threw it in the puddle again, so I had to just read it off the internet. But there you go. If you're talking about voter suppression, nothing works like foreclosure. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm in New Orleans. Yes, I know. But it wasn't planned that way. It was going to hit Tampa, wasn't it? That's what I thought. Anyway, 7 years ago, this weekend, something was fixing to happen in New Orleans. And this weekend, something may be fixing to happen in New Orleans again. And we may get our first test of the new improved hurricane risk reduction system, built at great expense, yours and mine, by the United States Army Corps of Engineers, about whom more in a moment. But first, just a look at the question, how's New Orleans doing? Which, if you're from here, everybody asks you wherever you go, so, and especially at this time of year, except cable news. So here's some information from the Greater New Orleans Community Data Center. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, New Orleans was the fastest-growing large city in the United States between 2010 and 2011. The population is now at 74% of the 2000 population. The metro area has 90% of its 2000 population. New Orleans has weathered the recession relatively well. The area experienced a 0.1% decrease in jobs. The nation lost 3%. Entrepreneurship has spiked. 427 of every 100,000 adults starting a business during 2008-2010, compared with 333 nationally. During the 2010-11 school year, 68% of New Orleans public school students attended schools that passed state standards, up from 28% in 2003-2004. Blight is rapidly declining in New Orleans. Wow. Down from 65,000 blighted residential addresses in 2008 to roughly 35,000 in March of this year. Post-Katrina housing says the data center is unaffordable, with 60% of renters in the city paying more than 30% of their pre-tax income on rent and utilities in 2010, up from only half pre-flood. In 2009, the rate of violent crimes per 100,000 residents was 777 in New Orleans, nearly twice the national rate in 2009. Since 1932, 29% of the wetlands that protect the New Orleans area have been lost. The vast majority of the federal money that came here in the wake of the flood was for debris removal and emergency relief, not rebuilding. Approximately $75 billion of the $120 billion. Just some numbers for you. The city is more diverse, or the metro area is more diverse ethnically than it was before the flood. The percentage of New Orleans households without a vehicle fell from 27% in 2000 to 19% in 2010. That may be important in the days to come. And in the city of New Orleans, 33% of adults 25 and older had a college degree in 2010, up from 26% in 2000. That's a full 5 percentage points higher than the U.S. average. Yeah, we're smarter than you all. That all being said, we're not smart enough to avoid having to depend on these people.
Gentlemen, we are proud to present Let Us Try, a ballad of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Let us try to stem the tide.
All right, some news about the Corps, ladies and gentlemen, as we approach Flood Plus 7 Day. The commanding general of the Corps in the aftermath of the flood, Lieutenant General Carl Strock, told the New York Times in 2006 that the Corps accepted responsibility for the failures. Earlier this year, he told the Times-Picayune, used to be a daily paper here, that his statements about local officials' roles were not intended to be deceitful. He had said local officials prevented the Corps, or the Corps had said for years, local officials prevented the Corps from building a more robust system. I might have illustrated my description with things I had heard but not personally researched, he now says to the Times-Picayune. This is in response to a public records request for any documents that supported the Corps' allegations that they were pressured to build up the canal walls and not install floodgates. Things I had heard. Ken Holder is the public affairs chief for the Corps. He suggested in his response to that request for any documents that the Corps may have relied upon, he suggests review of an independent 33-page study called the Hurricane Protection Decision Chronology, prepared for the Corps in about 4 years ago. Buried deep in the report is an analysis showing that pre-flood, the Corps of Engineers misinterpreted one of its own studies, the so-called E-99 study. They tested their system of supporting concrete flood walls, so-called eye walls, because they don't have a horizontal piece going. I'm not going to explain engineering because I don't understand it, but eye walls, take it from me. So there's sheet metal driven down beneath the concrete to stabilize it. And they were testing, driving it down only 17 feet in soil similar to New Orleans. The Corps determined that even though they found that the wall therefore experienced some movement or leaning, that was safe enough. Those were the flood walls that collapsed and caused most of the death and destruction in New Orleans just a few years later. But it saved the Corps $100 million. Cost America $100 billion. The current story in New Orleans concerns a company which was contracted for by the Corps to floodproof the city's pumping stations, which pump out the rainwater. And the contractor that they had chosen, Benentech, apparently took the money from the Corps, the owner of the company, and gave it to his wife, a former cocktail waitress in a strip club, who's now in the movie business. Don't we all have that background, really? The Corps claims to have done due diligence on the contractor, but according to Lee Zurich of Project NOLA, around the same time that the Corps awarded, oh, and by the way, it was awarded as a set aside for veterans, but the owner of Benentech's father, who was a veteran, had nothing to do, apparently, with the day-to-day operation of the company. Just happened to be around. Handy. A handy vet. At the time the Corps awarded the two of the contracts to Benentech, the local airport, Louis Armstrong International, kicked Benentech off a multi-million dollar job because of a bad bond, insurance bond. A subcontractor at the LSU Dental School placed a lien on them for not paying for material and labor. That's right, they don't pay their subcontractors. And a subcontractor at the port in St. Bernard Parish placed a lien against the company for $100,000, saying Benentech didn't pay the subcontractors, and they had to finish the job because Benentech couldn't do the work. These actually happened, many of them, before the Corps awarded the contract. That is now not being used to flood-proof the pumps. And in the Let Us Try department, ladies and gentlemen, levees protecting most of the city of Sacramento and 15 other areas of California Central Valley were declared this week to have failed federal maintenance criteria by the Army Corps. As a result, they're no longer eligible for federal money to rebuild if they're damaged in a storm. The Corps concluded that a new state plan to improve Central Valley levees does not provide enough detail to ensure that maintenance problems, such as erosion and intruding structures, homes built too close to the levees, will be fixed. The Corps didn't say they're going to do anything about it. Not even going to ask that they be allowed to try. Hello, welcome to the show.
It's a marvelous night for a moon dance, with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance, neath the cover of October skies. All the leaves on the trees, they are falling to the sound of the breezes that blow. And I'm trying to please to the calling of your heartstrings, they play soft and low. All of the night's magic seems to whisper and hush. All of the soft moonlight seems to shine in your blush. Can I just have one more dance with you, my love? Can I just make some more romance with you, my love?
Well, I wanna make love to you tonight. I can't wait till the morning has come. Yet I know now the time it is just right. And straight into my arms you will run. When you come, my heart will be waiting to make sure that you're never alone. There and then all my dreams will come true, dear. There and then I will make you my own.
trees are all falling to the sound of the breezes that blow. And I'm trying to please to the calling of your heartstrings they play soft and low.
From under the protective wing of the United States Army Corps of Engineers here in New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of Le Show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of Nice Corp. Nice people doing nice things. Well, you probably know by now that the Prince, Prince Harry, no relation, why would there be, has been found to have cavorted in Las Vegas. And strangely enough, things that happened in Vegas didn't stay in Vegas. He was photographed. How do people photograph people getting naked playing strip billiards? How does that happen? And an angry Rupert Murdoch ordered his newspaper, his tabloid newspaper, The Sun, to publish those pictures in defiance of the wishes of the royal family, because he wanted to send a warning shot to Judge Leveson, who is investigating the phone hacking and computer hacking and police payoff scandal involving Rupert Murdoch's newspapers. Warning shot. This is according to The Independent, a competing newspaper in London. He phoned the News International chief executive Tom Mockridge from New York this week, says The Independent, amid suggestions that The Sun and other papers not carry the photos for fear of recriminations by Judge Leveson. On Friday, The Sun carried a picture of a naked Prince Harry taken during that game of strip pool. News International refused to comment on speculation that Murdoch intervened, but according to a well-placed source, Murdoch told Mockridge in his transatlantic phone call, "There is a principle here. I know this is about Leveson. This is humiliating. We can't carry on like this. We should run them, do it, and say to Leveson, we're doing it for press freedom." That's the quote from supposedly Rupert Murdoch.
Writing in...
That's not Rupert Murdoch. And that's not new Rupert Murdoch. So we're a 0-for-2 on the Rupert Murdoch quotes actually being expressed here vocally, ladies and gentlemen. But onward with the story, then, as one must. The Sun's decision to publish the pictures sparked both criticism and praise from the commentariat, as well as 850 complaints from members of the public. Remember the public? They're the people who read the papers? Complaining to a commission which supposedly investigates complaints about the press in Britain. It also triggers the debate about what constitutes the public interest, given the fact that Prince Harry, an officer in the British Army, was in his hotel room despite partying with several strangers. It was his hotel room. Neil Wallace, a former executive editor of News of the World, the shuttered tabloid owned by Rupert Murdoch, said this was a decision taken by Rupert. Rupert cares passionately about newspapers. He thinks this stuff is important. This is the only good thing that has happened at News International for a year. Once they knew they were going to do it, there was just a magnificent morale boost.
Yeah, I think we can stand that embarrassment.
Okay, Rupert. Thank you. It is nice people doing nice things. And, ladies and gentlemen, the people just get nicer. Here is Rupert Murdoch's daughter, Elizabeth, delivering part of the so-called McTaggart Lecture at the Edinburgh International Television Festival a couple of years after her brother James delivered the same lecture.
Writing in McTaggart has been quite a welcome distraction from some of the other nightmares much closer to home. Yes, you have met some of my family before. The committee may be less than keen on women, but by God, you do love a Murdoch. Despite a valuable contribution to this debate, James ended his lecture with a line in which he claimed that the only reliable and perpetual guarantor of independence is profit. He clearly intended that statement to be provocative. And it is. But I also think that it deserves further analysis. James was right that if you remove profit, then independence is massively challenged. But I think that he left something out. The reason his statement sat so uncomfortably is that profit without purpose is a recipe for disaster. It is increasingly apparent that the absence of purpose or of a moral language within government, media, or business could become one of the most dangerous own goals for capitalism and for freedom.
Elizabeth Murdoch, ladies and gentlemen. Nice people doing nice things. Own goal, by the way, is in soccer, where a team kicks a ball, the ball into its own goal. So it's defeating itself, helping to defeat itself. Just thought I'd point that out for in case you don't have kids. And now, ladies and gentlemen, another copyrighted feature of this very broadcast. News of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm.
Inch by inch along parts of the East Coast, global climate change is running in what scientists warn is geology's version of fast forward, swamping and eroding beaches, wetlands, and farm fields. Shorelines from North Carolina to New Jersey to Boston are in a hot zone for sea level rise and will experience water levels rising at double the rate of most places in the planet, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. That's largely because, in addition to a rising sea level, this stretch of coast is also slowly sinking. These are people who were pointing fingers in New Orleans a few years ago. Scientists say the treasured lifestyle of residents along the coast of the Mid-Atlantic could change dramatically by the time this year's high school graduates are retirees. So kids, don't retire. Prevent sea level rise. The larger issue for taxpayers is where to spend money and energy attempting to hold back the ocean and where to retreat and allow nature to take its course. Along the New Jersey, Delaware, and Maryland coasts. By the way, didn't Elizabeth Murdoch sound, based on her accent and delivery, didn't she sound like a member of Slow Talkers of Canada? I don't know. I don't think so. Anyway, along those coasts, sea levels could rise faster and higher, nearly 1.5 feet in the next 40 years than the average of the globe. 3.5 to nearly 5 feet by the end of the century. That could swamp tens of thousands of homes and businesses along the coasts. So, you might want to move here. You might want to think about it. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. It is a copyrighted feature of this very broadcast. And now, the world of the atom.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Save, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, save, too safe to meet. Save, save, too safe to meet.
Addie didn't come. Addie, you weren't originally planning to come here.
No, it's hurricane season.
And yet here you are.
Yeah, well, I snuck in your bag.
Really? And the TSA?
No, never knew.
Wow. Deadline Boston, the U.S. government is looking into claims by a cybersecurity researcher that flaws in software for specialized networking equipment from Siemens, the German electrical giant, not the improper pronoun for sailors, could enable hackers to attack power plants and other critical systems. Justin Clark, an expert in securing industrial control systems, disclosed at a conference in L.A. this week that he'd figured out a way to spy on traffic moving through networking equipment manufactured by Siemens' RuggedCom division. apparently not rugged enough. The Department of Homeland Security said in an alert released this week it had asked RuggedCom to confirm the vulnerability that Clark, a 30-year-old security expert who has long worked in the electric utility field, had identified and identify steps to mitigate its impact. RuggedCom is a Canadian subsidiary of Siemens. It sells networking equipment for use in harsh environments, such as areas with extreme weather, like Earth. Says it's investigating Clark's findings. It declined to elaborate. If you can get to the inside, there's almost no authentication, there are almost no checks and no balances to stop you, he said of the flaw, because hackers could gain credentials to access computer systems that control power plants and other critical systems.
That's not a nuclear problem, that's a computer problem.
All right, then. Here's a nuclear problem. For the first time, a leak of highly radioactive waste has been detected from a double-shelled tank at the Hanford nuclear site in Washington State. The public interest group Hanford Challenge this week released a memo from the Department of Energy inspectors to the Washington State Department of Ecology detailing the leak. Dated a week and a half ago, the memo acknowledges a highly radioactive chemical waste leak that was detected in early this month from tank AY-102 on the floor of the annulus. There's a wonderful new word for you. That's the space between the two walls of the double-shelled tank. The annulus. It's an annulus horribilis, apparently. The dry radioactive waste was found in two locations, according to the memo. One of them in a mound, apparently 2 feet by 3 feet by 8 inches.
That's a mini mound.
Mm-hmm. The Hanford site holds two-thirds of the nation's high-level radioactive waste left over from plutonium production during World War II and the Cold War. It's now the most contaminated nuclear site in the United States, the focus of the nation's largest environmental cleanup. The normal process is for the waste to go into stainless steel containers once it's been vitrified. Look it up, babe. 67 Hanford tanks have leaked over 1 million gallons of radioactive waste into the soil so far, but until now, all of them were the older style single-shell tanks. The waste in those single-shell tanks is being removed fast into the tanks with double shells as a safety measure. Double-shell tanks have two steel walls with a tank-within-a-tank design that adds to the safety margin, except there's a leak in the annulus.
I have my annulus checked once a year.
You don't have an annulus. As fish die in record numbers across Illinois this summer because of the intense heat and drought, state officials are granting power plants special exemptions to flush massive amounts of hot water into the already stressed lakes and rivers. The Illinois Environmental Protection Agency is allowing power plants to dump hundreds of millions of gallons of water per day at temperatures approaching 100 degrees into the state's waterways, according to the Chicago Tribune. Temperature-sensitive fish have already been swimming deeper to find cooler water or have been abandoning environmentally inhospitable areas during the heat and drought. But with power plant operators dumping hot water at record amounts, environmentalists say species along with the rivers and lakes they live in could face increased risks.
Hey, it's hot.
Well observed. Physical and mental fatigue have been the main causes of death among evacuees following last year's Fouk disaster, including 34 who died of stress over the disaster, according to a new survey. So it's not just the radiation, it's the stress.
You can have stress working on Wall Street.
And the health effects of ionized radiation have become a hot topic around the globe. A new study shows that survivors of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki nuclear bombings have continued to show a higher than normal risk of thyroid cancer over half a century after their initial exposures. So, as I say in another context, radiation is forever. Take the pat down. You okay, Eddie?
I'm feeling hot.
Clean, cheap, too safe to meter. Our friend, the Atom. Ladies and gentlemen, this week, news came that a gentleman discovered a heretofore unreleased tape recording that his father had made for an interview never published, a tape recorded interview with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Here's an excerpt.
I would say nonviolence means the refusal to use violence in any way in order to achieve a social end. It means refusing to use external physical violence and also refusing to use internal violence of spirit. And I would also say that it is a method which seeks to secure moral ends through moral means.
Well, we've come a long way since then, haven't we, ladies and gentlemen? Now, another tape has surfaced this week from about 10 years later, a different cultural era.
And now a message for the patrons of this theater from the president of the NAAA, the National Association for the Advancement of Afro-Americans, Dr. George Stevens.
Hello. I've just been reading a very important motion picture script, which has already been filmed. Why am I reading the script when I could be watching the movie? Simply because I feel this film is of great importance, not just to the Afro-American community, but to all Negroes. For this is the first motion picture, to our lawyer's knowledge, that has dared to be suggested by the life of the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. It serves as a living testimonial to the dignity of man and to the beauty of his woman. I have never before been asked to endorse a motion picture, and so it is with deep pride and humility that I urge you to owe it to yourself to undergo this uplifting cinematic experience.
He's back.
He's bad.
He's black.
He's glad.
He's Kingpin.
Black Ivory Productions presents a Zodiac International release.
Kingpin.
He's a king, he's a pin, he's a kingpin.
Introducing Denver Devereaux Jr., 8th round draft pick of the New York Jets in his motion picture debut, is Kingpin.
And he's got a plan to stick it to the Klan.
Sorry, fella, but you gotta get to the back on this bus.
Listen, you honky donkey, nobody tells Kingpin to get back.
I thought you were nonviolent, Kingpin.
Sure, man. Only when I'm dreaming.
Got a dream, got the steam to be Kingpin.
They call him the Doctor, and he's got a special treatment for Whitey's four-wheel jive.
If anybody's gonna be called Mr. Charlie, it's gonna be Kingpin.
You can't muscle me out of this, Kingpin. This is the biggest march Washington has ever seen.
Dig this and dig it deep, Congressman Muldoon. If there's gonna be snow in Washington, it's gonna be black snow. Now you take your business elsewhere, white boy.
Oh, this would be a heck of a time for my feet to desert me.
When we gonna get out of this scene? When we gonna go away to the mountains? Just the two of us.
The man won't let me, honey. I'm in too deep.
Forget the man. Think about your woman.
Oh, boy.
Ain't no bluff, not the stuff to be Kingpin.
If you want to get it together and see the brother who predicted the weather, dress your mother up in leather and see Kingpin.
The critics agree
it's bad.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
And I think we have to start with this one. Congressman Todd Akin, who ignited a firestorm this week with his comments about so-called legitimate rape, victims of so-called legitimate rape, women who had been victims, that was his phrase, their bodies had some way of shutting down so that they wouldn't get pregnant. So there didn't need to be a rape exception in a prohibition of abortion. That was the whole point of the exercise. And here is the part of the campaign commercial Todd Akin released as Republicans of all stripes said, "Get out of the race."
"I'm Todd Akin, and I approve this message. Rape is an evil act. I used the wrong words in the wrong way, and for that I apologize. The mistake I made was in the words I said, not in the heart I hold. I ask for your forgiveness."
Don't hold your heart, babe. Don't hold your breath either, but please don't hold your heart. That can get so messy. A senior banker at one of Australia's largest investment banks apologized for suggesting that Hitler was a great visionary. Michael Hawker, an independent non-executive director of the board of Macquarie Group, told a meeting of bank executives in Sydney that you have to paint a great picture. You have to paint a great picture of your vision of the future if you want people to follow. Hitler painted a great picture. Well, maybe not from another point of view, unquote. He issued a statement this week saying these comments were insensitive and inappropriate, and I apologize unreservedly for them and any offense or hurt they have caused, unquote. Jewish officials, oddly enough, slammed the Hitler analogy by Hawker, a former Australian rugby player, which explains the brain damage. Dateline Marikana, South Africa. South Africa's defense minister apologized this week to angry miners who held up plastic packets of bullet casings, the first government official to beg forgiveness for the police shootings that killed 34 striking miners, wounded another 78, and shocked that nation. The most deadly display of state violence since apartheid ended in 1994. Defense Minister Mapisa Nkula's apology came at the site of the killings, where hundreds of mourners walked barefoot earlier in a ceremony to bless the site. A BBC weatherman actually apologized on air a week ago for an incorrect forecast. The network had announced Sunday would be a hot and dry day for southwestern England, but as storm clouds gathered, viewers began to question the accuracy, and then the sky burst open with rainy thunderstorms around 11 in the morning. Weatherman Philip Avery apologized on the air a couple hours later. "The thunderstorms there, which were not represented in our forecasts over the past couple of days or so," he said. "I have to say, we can't even blame the computers. The computers actually wanted to put these thunderstorms in there, but forecasters thought it wasn't supported by enough evidence, and so we went for the dry, hot option. Apologies to anyone who has had their next few hours ruined." That's the way to do it. Cook County, Chicago board president Tony Prickwinkle has publicly apologized for what she calls an inflammatory comment she made about the late President Ronald Reagan. She said Reagan deserved, quote, "a special place in hell," unquote, for his war on drugs policy. She's sorry about how she said it. "I said I regretted my inflammatory remarks, and I also said I'm not going to stop talking about this issue," she said. "We're spending an incredible amount of money on detaining and incarcerating people. We ought to be investing in treatment," she added. Dateline Sydney, Australia. Cue another bad Australian accent. The Orthodox Jewish school in Melbourne, embroiled in a child sex abuse scandal, apologized unreservedly to its victims. The apology, issued in a letter from the head of the Yeshiva College and the head of the Yeshiva Center, which houses the headquarters of Chabad in Melbourne, said, quote, "We appreciate and understand that there are victims who feel aggrieved, and we sincerely and unreservedly apologize for any historical wrongs that may have occurred," unquote. This is 6 weeks after a judge ordered David Cypress, a former security guard contracted to the college, to stand trial next year for multiple child sex abuse charges perpetrated over two decades ago on 12 students, three of whom now reside here in the United States. Manny Wax, the only Australian-based victim who has spoken out, said the apology was, quote, "an important milestone." A Republican candidate for sheriff in New Hampshire apologized this week after saying he could use deadly force if necessary to stop an abortion doctor. This is in the wake of the Todd Akin stuff. Quote, "I want to be clear to the people of New Hampshire. I made several comments about the use of deadly force against abortion doctors that I regret, that I apologize for, and that I fully retract," said Hillsborough County Sheriff candidate Frank Szabo. "In making comments yesterday, I let my passionate stance against abortion get the better of me." Also, probably the double scotch. Again, Australia. Australia's leader denies she personally benefited from helping a boyfriend set up a union fund 17 years ago, addressing the scandal this week for the first time in a likely acknowledgement that silence could harm her re-election chances. The accusations have dogged Prime Minister Julia Gillard for years, but her news conference came after the Australian newspaper, owned by Rupert Murdoch, apologized on its website for reporting that Gillard had set up the trust fund for a top official with a union. Gillard was a lawyer at the time and had only given legal advice to Wilson, then her live-in romantic partner. News Limited apologized and retracted three reports in 5 years relating to the union fund. Nice people doing nice things. Lake Sumter, Florida Community College President Lee Mojock apologized this week after a participant in an estate planning seminar complained that a speaker held a drawing to give away a punching bag depicting President Obama as a black-eyed boxer. Nearly 12 hours after the Twitter account of Milind Deora, India's Minister of State for Communications and Information Technology, was suspended, the social networking website restored his account and apologized for the mistake. The official said the minister's account got suspended because Twitter probably made an error while processing a request to verify his account. That would be a process by which you know that he is the real guy that he claims to be, just like the Harry Shearer is now a verified Twitter account. And they didn't even bother to suspend me as part of the process, for which I must say I'm utterly, utterly, utterly grateful. More apologies. A Richmond, Indiana man says federal agents that entered his home during an early morning raid this week did not arrest anyone and later returned items they seized and issued an apology to him. Ruben Colon said he was awakened Friday morning by FBI agents executing a search warrant. There was nothing found. They came in and wouldn't tell us what they were looking for and wouldn't tell us what was going on. I was scared to death when the first thing you see when you open the door is a gun. That is pretty messed up, he said. The FBI has apologized. ABC Monday apologized for reports stating that late Top Gun director Tony Scott had inoperable brain cancer that spurred his suicide last week. Scott's family told authorities they were not aware the director had cancer or any other severe health complications. The network cited a source close to the filmmaker in its initial report. Of course, earlier this summer, ABC erroneously reported that Batman shooter James Holmes was connected to a Colorado Tea Party group. Good work, ABC. Move Nightline later. That'll fix it. And finally, during a fact-finding congressional trip to the Holy Land last summer, Representative Kevin Yoder, Republican of Kansas, took off his clothes and jumped into the sea. Other participants, including the daughter of another congressman, swam fully clothed. He has now apologized for the nudity, not for the swimming. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, it is a copyrighted feature of this very broadcast.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is Now and Then. Now and Then, an occasional series about unoccasional news events seen through the prism of occasionality. I'm Milton Getzler. In just a few short hours, the gavel will fall, or more properly be wielded in a direction coincident with gravity, to open the 2012 Republican National Convention. And although the modern political convention is largely a parade of infomercials, punctuated by speeches generated by the nominee's apparatus and delivered by hopeful future nominees, CPR will bring you live gavel-to-gavel coverage, since it's still cheaper than covering real news. That, of course, not only enables, but requires us to have a pre-convention roundtable with some of our correspondents here in Tampa. So joining me to take a look ahead at what in just 5 days we'll be looking back at, here is CPR national correspondent Ira Zipkin.
Hello, Milton.
And CPR's special correspondent, Aviva Schlorman.
Hi, Milton. Have I given you my boobies recipe for the perfect late summer refreshment, iced schmaltz? I will.
And joining us also is CPR's Youthquake correspondent, host of What Up Dog, Cody Outscoop.
Word, Milton.
Cody, part of your beat is monitoring social networks. Mm-hmm. What's the Twitter sphere and the Facebookopolis saying about the Republican convention?
Milton, I describe social network activity on this story so far as being fairly neatly divided into two camps, people repeating what they're hearing in the media and other people ignoring it.
Cody, we read about the increasing disillusionment with President Obama in what might be called the hip-hop leadership community. In the run-up to the convention, has there been any vocal hip-hop support for Mitt Romney?
Well, there couldn't be instrumental hip-hop support, could there?
Well, sure. Some of them play. Ira, Vanilla Ice was reported to have sent around a price sheet for various levels of endorsement. We've not yet seen any public indications of his sapizzle for Governor Romney. On the other hand, a lot of the traders in the high-frequency derivatives trading business are people in their 20s, and Mitt Romney is getting plenty of backing from them. Out.
We'll let you back in a moment. Aviva, you've been covering some of the more prominent women arriving here in Tampa for the convention.
Yes.
How did they feel about the Democrats' renewed charges of a GOP war against women?
Milton, I guess you could say they're somewhere between conscientious objectors and civilian noncombatants. Sheila Batchelder is a Republican committee woman from Nebraska, and when I asked her for her reaction to the controversy around Congressman Todd Akin's comments about so-called legitimate rape, she told me two things. One, that Representative Akin was speaking for a lot of Bible-believing, socially conservative Republicans, and two, that he was put up to this whole thing by the liberal media elite. And she wished me a blessed day.
And what was your reaction?
I gave her some soup.
Ira Zipkin, this is your fifth Republican convention for CPR. Mm-hmm. Are you looking forward to it or dreading it?
Well, neither, Milton. Just retaining my normal sang-froid, I think.
Well, you did get an exclusive interview with a presumptive presidential candidate this week, didn't you?
He did grant CPR a brief exclusive chat between his exclusive interviews with Armed Forces Digest and Modern Rancher, and I asked him whether his selection of Congressman Paul Ryan as his running mate means that he's embraced the Ryan budget plan passed by the House this year.
Ira, if and when I have the honor to be the nominee of my party, the budget plan I will support will be the Romney budget plan, and I hope and I expect that the same will be said if and when Congressman Ryan has a somewhat lesser honor conferred on him.
And if, as expected, the Republican platform has a no-exceptions anti-abortion plank, will you support that?
Again, Ira, if I have that honor, the abortion position I'll support will be the Romney position. Other people in the party are free to take other positions. We're a big party. We're still a big tent, although I'll admit that some of the flaps have been moved inward in the last few years, but...
Well, on Friday, in a last-minute move, your campaign pushed through a rules change, mm-hmm. giving Romney supporters in the National Committee the right to change any rule without a vote of the convention delegates. Is that something you support?
Ira, I'm getting a little tired of answering the same question, but just with some of the specifics changed. Let me just put it to you this way. As the presidential candidate of my party, which I hope and expect to be, I can firmly assure you that the Romney position on any issue won't be the position of some committee or some organization. It will most definitely be the Romney position.
Well, that answers that. Aviva, you're also on the emotion beat.
Yes.
Is there any sign that the governor has figured out how to make voters warm to him?
Milton, in the most recent CPR Reader's Digest poll, we asked female respondents which candidate they'd prefer to have a first date with. Mitt Romney got a 27% response, and of course we have to add that this poll, due to its small response rate, had a margin of error of 36%, so this is within that. Still, it's something to think about.
Or at least to listen to. Well, they're making final preparations down on the convention floor and battening down the hatches outside. So that'll have to wrap up our attempt to anticipate what in just a few short hours will be old news. For all of us on the convention team, I'm Milton Getzler, thanking you for joining us on Now and Then. Support came from the Harcourt Foundation. Harcourt, making a better future part of a better tomorrow. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
And moonlight, it's so easy when you're in love. When you have someone to cling to, when your heart is not your own. You are lonely.
when you are your one and only Eve. When there's no one else to share. And moonlight, like a movie made for lovers, so oblivious to others. Stardust in the air and moonlight in me, like the moment when love found you. All around astounds you. Keeps me wishing you were here. Wishing you were here. Wishing you were here, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, the family of Neil Armstrong has suggested that the greatest way to pay respect to him is this weekend when you're out in the evening, look up at the moon and wink at it. And as a former astronaut recruiter for NASA, I second the notion. And now, ladies and gentlemen,
he's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an
inspector general. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, news of Inspector General. The money-losing U.S. Postal Service guessed that TV cartoon character Homer Simpson and his family were twice as popular as Elvis Presley when it came to sales of commemorative stamps. They were wrong. In a move that wasted $1.2 million in printing costs, the service produced 1 billion stamps of the Simpsons family, sold only 318 million. Postal Service Inspector General, in a report, singled out the overproduction of such stamps, marking the 20th anniversary of the cartoon's run on News Corporation's Fox Network. Nice corporation, I call it. As an example of failing to align production with demand. If the Postal Service can't address a simple matter such as determining how many commemorative stamps to produce, it shows they can't address the larger problems, says Tom Schatz, president of Citizens Against Government Waste. The Inspector General probe found no instances in 2009 and 10 in which there was more demand for commemorative stamps than supply, you see. The Simpson stamps sold in 2009 and 10 came in five designs with Homer, his wife Marge, and children Bart, Lisa, and baby Maggie. The stamp sold for 44 cents, 1 cent less than it now costs to mail the letters, which means they're now worthless or worth more. Next time, maybe other characters like the TV Guide covers could help, couldn't hurt. The Federal Aviation Administration doesn't keep good track of how many times planes strike birds, and its inspectors often aren't familiar with wildlife, according to an Inspector General's report this week. Jeffrey Guzzetti, Assistant Inspector General for Aviation at the Transportation Department, says the FAA can't be sure that airports have good plans for coping with wildlife, or that FAA inspectors who review the plans have expertise in wildlife. Reported bird strikes have quintupled in the past two decades. So at least somebody's striking. Because the FAA said in a statement this week the agency has taken a comprehensive approach to reduce wildlife strikes since 1960 using better research, technology, training, and online reporting. The FAA has already adopted and completed a majority of the Inspector General's recommendations, they say. The danger of bird strikes was dramatically illustrated in January 2009 when a U.S. Airways flight taking off from LaGuardia struck Canada geese and Sully Sullenberger landed the plane in the Hudson River. No flights are immune. Vice President Biden's plane hit birds in April while landing at Santa Barbara Airport in California, but was able to land. There were no injuries. If they'll strike the vice president, ladies and gentlemen, they'll strike anybody. News of the Inspectors General, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Almost forgot. Here's something you won't hear on any other public radio program. News that my new album, Can't Take a Hint, drops tomorrow, August 27th, at Amazon and iTunes. You can do what you want. No call to action here. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this edition of... Oh, with guest stars like Dr. John, Jane Lynch, Fountains of Wayne, Jamie Cullum, and more, Nicholas Payton. Enough said. That concludes this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.490 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com and available as a free podcast for KCRW.com. And it would be just like you going to iTunes and Amazon or something if you would agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Uh-huh. A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Hawaii, and Chicago desks, and to our whistleblower friend inside the Corps of Engineers. Thanks to Jenny Lawson here at WWNO in New Orleans for helping to make today's program audible. And thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. This broadcast is on Twitter. Join the almost 68,000 folks at the Harry Shearer. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm shutting the shutters and opening the openers. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the Rubber Promise and the home of the homeless. So long from New Orleans.